This is Layla Mudin, RD. I see patients every day here at the Hoffman Center. If you require a nutrition consult with me, but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.
Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. It's part two of our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Radio program at AOL.com is the place to send your questions. And we'll likely have a couple of weeks of backlog to clear before we get your questions. So be patient. Keep listening. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman. How's it going?
Good, good. And so what's our next question, please?
We've got an email from Stan who writes, I take about 1 tablespoon of colloidal silver and colloidal copper about every other day. I also take about 15 drops of 8% hydrogen peroxide. Is that good or bad? Now, Stan doesn't tell us anything else.
Right, right.
Like why he's taking it or what.
Right. So
now, I remember this.
Yeah.
From anybody taking silver without taking a break, I keep remembering the Blue Man on Oprah.
Yeah. Well, you know, do you know that the Blue Man came to our office? Did you know that?
No. I wasn't here. It must have been before my time.
A Blue Man. I don't know if it's the same Blue Man who came to Oprah, but I...
I remember the Blue Man.
Do you remember the Blue Man?
Okay.
This is what happened, and for our listeners who don't know the story, I was coming out of my office, you know, as I do, you know, I peek out of my office, I see what's going on, you know, is a patient waiting or, you know, do they have something to tell me? And I'm walking up to the front and I see, the gals at the front desk face me and there's a person standing at the front desk with his back turned to me and the girls at the front desk look a little consternated. You know, and I recognize this is not a patient. And the patient, you know, has straight, hair that is sort of light brown colored. And, you know, you can kind of racially profile people, you know, pretty quickly. You know, Caucasian individual, from the back. And, as I walked up to the front, I saw his face and he was not Caucasian. But he also wasn't African American. He was a dark color blue, like really not sky blue, but like midnight blue, and with Caucasian features and blue eyes.
Uh-huh.
And I said, you know, wow, this is like an episode of Star Trek, you know, like the, you know, like a yeah. you know, or Blue Man Group, you know, something like that.
Right, Blue Man Group.
Blue Man Group, and he was. And I could see he was trying to pitch my front desk, that he wanted to come directly in to see me, even though he didn't have an appointment, to tell me about the benefits of silver, you know, taking colloidal silver.
Was he a rep for some company?
No, he was just an individual, and he was a little bit, shall we say, eccentric. Anyway, I kind of nodded my head, tipped my hat, and said, look, I gotta go see a patient, and I kind of ducked back into my office, and essentially they told him, you know, they gave him a little bit the bum's rush, and he was gone. Now, this was an example of someone who got overzealous with silver, and it can happen. And I, you know, the claim is that with the right colloidal silver, you don't get that effect. But if it's prepared improperly, or blah blah blah, some people literally make it in their bathtub. You can make it in a way that is with electric current. You separate it out, and you actually can prepare it. But if the preparation goes wrong, you will accumulate silver, and it's a metal, and it's going to have a tattooing like effect. I guess if you take enough,
Dr. Hoffman, if it is prepared properly, should someone take it indefinitely?
Well, that's a good question. The colloidal silver used to be used in the pre-antibiotic era, mostly topically, and it's still used actually to coat catheters, for example, because catheters are develop biofilms. It's a wonderful disinfectant. And in fact, you can even buy sportswear that has little silver threads in it. Also, you can buy sportswear that has little copper threads in it. And that's antibacterial so that your sportswear doesn't stink. And so there's really something to that, that silver repels bacteria. Now, so some people take it in the mistaken idea that they can fend off infections. Some people take it because they have Lyme disease that's hard to treat. They have some kind of chronic viral infection, they think, or they've been told, and they take it to, you know, get rid of that. So I'm not a big fan of oral ingestion of that. You know, some of my colleagues are, and they think it's really beneficial, but I'm a little concerned about any heavy metal because we spend so much time trying to get lead out, mercury out. Why introduce something at high doses that's potentially dangerous? But for topical use, I kind of like it. I actually think it might be helpful for certain infections. You can gargle with it. You can gargle with it. You can use it as a nasal wash for chronic sinusitis. We use a product called Argentin. And it's interesting, you know, the word French for money is argent, which means silver, silver. You know, that was the coin of the realm in, when that word was invented. So, okay, so let's get to the hydroperoxide. Hydroperoxide is also great. You know, we know that if you have, you know, a cut or something and you want to disinfect it, you can, you swish it around. But the problem is it's a highly oxidizing agent. And I have a concern, you know, what it does deep in your gastrointestinal tract. I mean, some people might say, well, we're not using enough to create a problem. But it is a bleach, and bleaches can, you know, be highly oxidizing. And who knows, long-term exposure, that might even create a higher risk of cancer. That's a concern. So I'm not a big fan of drinking hydroperoxide. There are some people who use hydroperoxide as a treatment for infections. They give it intravenously. I have, you know, some experience with that, many years ago. And I think that it is helpful for certain conditions, but I'm a little worried because it's caustic and it can damage the blood vessels and create irritation. So, now interestingly, it turns out that if you want to get hydroperoxide in the cells, one of the best ways to do that safely is to administer high dose vitamin C, because vitamin C, triggers the release of hydroperoxide, but only after it reaches the cells deep, in the tissues. And so you will get hydroperoxide production. So I think, you know, if you want to do hydroperoxide, consider high-dose vitamin C. I think it does deliver some of the benefits.
There we go.
But intravenously, not oral vitamin C, intravenous vitamin C.
Intravenous, yes, where you can get so much more, right.
Yeah.
Stan, you should probably stop what you're doing. Is that the consensus, Dr.?
Well, yeah, but I just don't even know what he's trying to achieve there. You know, he didn't give me any medical, you know, he didn't give me any rationale for doing it, you know.
Right, right.
And then there needs to be some pretty persuasive rationale for doing something as potentially risky as that. Or, you know, if he's doing it in moderation, he might get away with it and there may be some benefits, but there are some downsides, in my opinion.
Dan, thank you for your email, and best of luck to you.
Yeah.
All right. We have an email from Bob. Okay, Dr. Hoffman, get a load of this. Speaking of vegan diet, a visit to our ophthalmologist recently resulted in her emphatic recommendation that my wife and my eldest son go on a vegan diet.
A visit to what kind of doctor?
The forks over knives diet. What's that?
What type of doctor?
This is an ophthalmologist.
Oh, an ophthalmologist. You know, it's funny. I spoke to a patient who said that she, you know, I said, you really need to go back to your ophthalmologist. She had this like minor glaucoma problem. And I said, you know, you haven't been for a while, get an eye check. Or she had something. She had some abnormality. And she said, I don't want to go back to my ophthalmologist anymore. I said, why? She says, every time I go there, she's so vociferously propagandizes me about my being on a vegan diet, and she says that she's actually kind of abusive. She raises her voice, and she's yells at her for eating.
I wonder if this is the same ophthalmologist that Bob is writing to us about.
It might be, because there are probably not that many militant vegan ophthalmologists.
So Bob says that the ophthalmologist is particularly pushing this diet for my wife and son now because they both exhibit drusen in their eyes.
Okay.
And she believes this is due to their consumption of meat and dairy,
meat and fat,
and that it will only improve if they go vegan.
Right.
Is there any evidence that this could be true?
Well, that's a really good question. And I, you know, quite honestly, without getting, you know, substituting my agenda, which is that I believe that meat and fat have a place in the diet, I don't know if that hypothesis has been tested. It's kind of a, isn't it a little bit of an obscure hypothesis that drusen, an eye condition, I don't think they've ever done a study looking at whether, you know, it would have to be a long-term study. You'd have to do it for 5 or 10 or 15 years to see if the progression of drusen is halted when people go on a vegetarian diet versus people who are on just a regular diet. And it's possible, I'm going to admit that there's a possibility that that is the case. I don't think so. I think that you might achieve just, you know, equivalent benefits with a really clean paleo diet, for example, a diet that's relatively low in carbohydrates, because we know that eye changes occur when you take in too many carbs, too. You could, you know, see saying that
that's
the culprit
true.
Is, you know, meat and fat and saturated fat.
Yeah.
Just as easily, we could say the culprit is, you know, carbohydrates, refined carbohydrates in particular, but, you know, even minimizing dietary carbohydrates from starch might be equally beneficial. So, you know, I think here's where I have a problem is the, a doctor using their platform to push a relatively unproven concept on patients. Presumably this is a doctor who has embraced a vegetarian lifestyle herself. It's a she. Is it she?
It's she.
Yeah.
The ophthalmologist is a she.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so.
Forks over knives ever since she saw it, apparently. Yeah.
Right, and Forks Over Knives, of course, is a film that promotes, you know, it's an against animal cruelty and, you know, for the protection of the environment and makes, you know, climate change, invokes climate change as a reason to eat vegetables, which actually they've done economic analyses and they've actually found that raising, especially organic vegetables, you know, like these exquisite things that you get in the middle of the winter that would never grow in a northern climate, you know, that they, it's a tremendous amount of energy associated with, producing them and shipping them and keeping them refrigerated and keeping them fresh. You know,
that contributes to global warming too.
Yes. That, so they did economic analysis. They did an economic analysis and they found that, the benefits may be exaggerated. Unfortunately, some of the things that are the worst for you, like corn, wheat, and soy, are some of the cheapest foods to produce that are the least environmentally degrading, really.
Yeah.
Because they just grow like crazy, and, you know, they're easy to refine and then, you know, store and ship. And, you know, that was not a good reason to eat tons of those foods.
So is drusen a risk factor for macular degeneration?
Yes, okay, so what drusen are is they are, it's actually the word for snowdrift. If you look at the back of the eye in macular degeneration, you'll see a paleness of the back of the eye. And one feature of macular deterioration is drusen. But it's not clear that drusen respond necessarily to the ARIDS eye formulas, you know, the ones that have DHA and zinc and lutein and zeaxanthin. It's worth a try, but it's more the dry form of macular degeneration that is going to likely respond to nutrition.
Yeah. Okay.
And by the way, you know, let's say you do become vegan, okay? Let's say you do, and, you know, you're going to get plenty of, lutein from, you know, green leafy vegetables and zeaxanthin from corn and other pigmented, you know, orange, yellow, fruits and vegetables. But the, you know, the main source of, lutein, as you know, is what? It's eggs, egg yolks.
It's egg yolks.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And when you become
Absolutely.
A vegan, like a, you know, true vegan, you don't have egg yolks, so you're actually denying yourself one of the most potent sources of a nutrient that we know is associated with protection against macular degeneration. So it sounds to me like this is a person who, this doctor is in the grips of, again, an ideological bias where, you know, look, give her credit for applying nutritional principles to ophthalmology. I always like it when doctors emphasize, you know, use their visits as a teaching moment to get people to exhort people to be on a cleaner diet. But I'm not sure there's, I might be, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, we can search the archives or listeners can come up with this, but I don't think there's clear-cut evidence that the type of eye problem we're talking about responds to a vegan diet. Pretty sure not.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Bob, thank you for that very, very thoughtful question. Okay.
We have time for another question.
Okay. We've got one from Michael. Greetings, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Dr. Hoffman, I note that you suggest the probiotic VSL for people with inflammatory bowel disease. And I see that it only has one strain, Lactobacillus acidophilus. Is there any reason why people with IBD should only take that one strain rather than multiple ones, such as Dr. O'Hara's?
The reason is that it's not just Lactobacillus acidophilus. It's actually
it's eight strains of live freeze-dried bacteria,
yeah.
is what I'm finding. But
right. So I think what we're talking about is that it's like the general, the genus, or there's a lot of Lactobacillus species,
yeah.
Subspecies, but the label says it's got Lactobacillus in it. But then, you know, if we break it down, you know, what is in it? You know, there's several subspecies. So it is, in effect, a combination. What I'm reading is that it's got several things. It's got Lactobacillus acidophilus, Lactobacillus paris, KCI, Bifidobacterium lactis, Bifidobacterium bifidum.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm not mistaken.
It's got Bifidobacteria too, yeah.
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 Plantarum,
so
which
it's
is good
for
rhamnosis. Okay, so.
Yeah.
Also, we have it now in the form of a product called Orthobiotic. And
yes.
We also, you know, it's for those who want to get it, really the virtually the identical product, you can now get it through a company called Orthomolecular. They have sourced it from the same place that the people who make VSL have sourced it. And there's two forms of it. One is just for general protection, and it's a good thing for people to just take for general, you know, flora rebalancing. But for those who really have a serious problem, ulcerative colitis or Crohn's, we give it in these little sachets, like little tear-open packages. It's much more concentrated. It's a little more expensive, too, because it's a more potent formulation. And so you can get the regular, or you can get the strong. It's called Orthobiotic.
Right. Orthobiotic. And my understanding is that VSL-3 is quite expensive.
Yeah.
I don't think the Orthobiotic product comes even close in terms of how expensive it is. So.
And I think that was the rationale. It's like, why reinvent the wheel is because they managed to capture the benefits without and pass along some cost savings to people.
Right, right. Now, to answer Michael's questions, it's different probiotics for different conditions, different strokes for different folks, as you say, Dr. Hoffman.
Right.
So we're finding that not every probiotic generally suits every medical condition, and this in particular is pretty heavy-hitting for people with IBD.
Right.
Yeah.
And there's not many studies of the effects of probiotics in inflammatory bowel disease, but VSL has been studied in a small trial, and there were some advantages seen. So, you know, we obviously need more research. You know, it kind of depends on the individual, depends on the, you know, their flora balance, what they need.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to predict. It's almost like, you know, trial and error. It's like, give it a shot, see how you like it. Does it improve things? Do you react badly?
Right.
It's conceivable you could have an adverse reaction to a probiotic.
Testing is often recommended too, possibly a stool test.
Right.
Or,
but again, I have to say, I am capable of doing stool tests, but it doesn't provide me yet with enough guidance in terms of, like, precision targeting of what a person needs.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Great point. Okay. Michael, thank you for your email. Okay.
I think we can squeeze in one quick one. Is there such a thing as a quick question?
I don't have a quick one. I honestly don't have a quick one. Let me see here. Okay. A lot of health gurus brag that they move their bowels 3 times daily. It seems one consistent good bowel movement around 7 a.m. seems more natural.
Hmm.
How important do you think it is to move your bowels 3 times a day instead of just once? It seems to me those health gurus are probably eating too much fiber.
Right. You know, I think that an argument could be made for avoiding constipation because of the potential for toxins
Absolutely.
To accumulate, you know. But it people have different constitutions.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Some people
go once a day normally.
And that's fine.
And some people go 3 times a day on their normal diet.
Right.
As long as that's regular for them, it's perfectly fine.
Yeah, and I kind of resist these things. I mean, look, I think it's good to eat fiber.
Yeah.
But the problem is that some people are in sort of a fiber frenzy. They're so rigidly following fiber recommendations.
Exactly. And listen, you know, if you're taking Metamucil, don't take your vitamins at the same time because you're eating rope and yanking it through.
Okay.
If you take too much fiber, there is such a thing as too much fiber.
Yes.
You're basically just cleansing out your intestines. You're not going to absorb your nutrition the way you should.
Right, right.
So we have to be reasonable.
Right. Yeah, so this whole thing with the health gurus bragging about their bowel movements, you won't hear me bragging about my bowel movements.
Yeah.
You know, but, I think that's a little along the lines of like, you know, drink, you know, 18 glasses of water a day or, you know, have 3 bowel movements per day, you know, have sex, at least, you know, 4 times per week. You know, I don't think there's any prescriptive that dictates some of these things or defines perfect health.
Yeah. And it still would be different strokes for different folks, in my opinion.
Right. However, you know, I will say that one of the I've told the story before. Hopefully, I won't importune you with another repetition. But when I went to medical school, I quickly learned that you didn't have to go to every lecture. You pretty much some of the lectures were terrible, and so you could just go to the library and read about the subject and pass the exam. But there was one. I did see one lecture that I was looking forward to, and looked really practical. It was called Diarrhea and Constipation. So I said, hey, you know, that's really practical. That's news you can use. So I went to the lecture, and the guy started the lecture by asking the people in the class, well, how many people have 3 or less bowel movements per week? And some people raise their hands. How many people have daily bowel movements? Some people raise their hands. You know, about a third of the class. How many people have more than 1 bowel movement per day? About a third of the class raise their hands. And so he stood there for a moment, and it's sort of a portentous silence. And he announced, well, you're all normal. And then I was disappointed because I thought, like, you know, I already knew that, you know, for optimal health, you know, having 3 or less bowel movements per week probably isn't great. You know, so I thought, well, this guy really, you know, he's just trying to say, you know, everything's normal when actually, that may not be so good for you. There's, you know, studies that suggest that that is associated with higher risk for colon cancer, that's, you know, people, you know, have endotoxemia from toxins remaining in their body. I think some people get a little carried away. You know, they want to, like, purge, and they want to, like, you know, take enemas, and they get a little nuts when they, you know, go a day without a bowel movement. And that's almost, there's a little bit of a neurosis associated with that. And we don't want to stoke people's, you know, almost eating disorder, like, behavior, you know, where they try to purge and purge and purge because they feel toxic. That's not a good thing either. So, but I disagree with him. I think there is, you know, there's something short of, you know, you're all normal.
I agree.
So that's as short as possible answer to relatively an essay question. How do you tackle that question in less than 3 minutes?
Important question.
But great question. But, you know, I got to say, kudos to our listeners for coming up with, you know, very interesting questions today. So keep them coming. Radioprogram@AOL.com. Remember, you can consult with Layla at the Hoffman Center. You actually have your own patient coming in after we record this podcast, right?
Yes,
someone who's
after we're done.
Right, not even seeing me, but that's a more economical way sometimes to tap into the expertise of the Hoffman Center. working directly with Layla. If you've got medical records and you're under the supervision of a doctor, she'll be happy to see you and advise you and impart some of the, hopefully, wisdom that we apply to health problems here at the Hoffman Center. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.
Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Layla. And this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.